So if you've been here the last couple of weeks, you're wondering by now, what is the connection between Mother's Day and child dedications and the end of the world as we know it? And how did you guys plan this? There's better software for, you know, we can get you hooked up with better stuff. You can plan stuff better than this, and we know. We've just been teaching through the book of Matthew, and this is just where we find ourselves landing. And yet, I guess this is biblical. There's some connections that Jesus makes. Earlier here in chapter 24, Jesus says, all these things are the beginning of birth pains. Moms, you know what that's about, right? You got that. So there is some kind of connection to these scripturally. Last week we saw Jesus say this, and alas for women who are pregnant and who are nursing as infants in those days. Pray that your flight may not be in winter or on the Sabbath. That sounds like really good news, right? So there's these funny little connections, but with all kidding kind of aside, on a bit more serious note, we learned last week that, and we'll learn again this week, that there is actually a deeper connection between what women know and experience in childbirth and these kinds of things, little connections with motherhood, and sort of the end of all things, there actually is. And the deeper connection is this. It's based on what we do know and what we don't know. It's based on what we do know and what we don't know. So when you're having children, when you're getting ready to have children, when you're pregnant and you know the baby's coming, and as the trimester, you know, the first trimester progresses and the second and the third, as you get later there in the third trimester, you start feeling in no uncertain terms, oh, this baby is coming. And when I say you start, I'm not talking based on firsthand knowledge. I'm just have watched this happen a couple of times. And it seems that moms know. It seemed that my wife knew. It seemed that the women in this church know. They know when the children are coming, but they don't know exactly when. You can never pinpoint that time. I guess these days you can. You can schedule a cesarean section, right? And you can go in and have all your stuff, and you could schedule the exact time. But for the most part, you know it's coming, but you don't know exactly when. And this constant sense of tension keeps you living with a sense of anticipation, right? You've got the car packed, you've got the bag in the trunk, and you've made a trip to the hospital, and it was just Braxton Hicks, and then you're back, and you repack, and you do your thing, and you just live with this constant sense of anticipation because you're in this tension of knowing it's coming, but we don't know exactly when it is coming. And this sense of anticipation is the same kind of anticipation that Jesus is emphasizing this morning in his teaching on the end of all things and the time that he is coming. The end of the world as we know it. There was a song like that, wasn't there? Yeah. R.E.M. Was it R.E.M.? Yes. Nice. I still have it. It's good. Pastor David last week said this. What we do know for sure about the end times should keep us from slowing down our gospel mission to worry about what we don't know for sure about the end times. This is what David said last week, and it's true. We're in this tension of what we do know and what we don't know. So this morning, what we do know is this. We do know that the coming of Jesus is going to be near. It says, learn this lesson from the fig tree. What is the lesson from the fig tree? Well, in that area of the world, most of the trees, they kept their leaves all the time. There were a couple of trees that didn't. The fig tree was one of them. And the fig tree would lose its leaves during the winter, and the leaves would come back during the late spring, and then you would know that summer was coming. And it was like clockwork, like the cherry blossoms back east. It just happened all the time. And you didn't know the exact day, and you try to plan it, and you try to get there, you know, with your plane flight at the right time and all, but you can't do that. You know about when it's coming, but you don't know exactly when. But you know that it's near. You know that it's near at the very gates. So we know that the return of Jesus is near. And you might be thinking to yourself, that's what the church has thought for 2,000 years. And yes, for 2,000 years it's been near. And in a sense, every Christian has been living in the last days. Listen to me, God lives outside of time. It's very, very near to him. And it's probably nearer than you and I think. What we do know is that it's near. What we do know also is that the end of the world will be like the destruction of Jerusalem. And I'm not going to spend much time here because David spent a lot of time here last week. And if you missed it and you're interested, you can listen. He did a fantastic job with this. But Jesus also says, truly I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all of these things take place. What were all of these things? Last week we saw that all these things were the things that are in Matthew chapter 24. All of the things like darkness and earthquakes and wars and rumors of wars and people's hearts growing cold and these kinds of things that will happen before the coming of the days when the temple in Jerusalem is destroyed. And there is debate about why Jesus mentions it here this way, and in Mark, he mentions it, and it's the same, but it's kind of arranged a little differently. And what we know in the big picture is this: what we do know is that the return of Jesus is near. What we do know also is that the return of Jesus is gonna look something like the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem. There are gonna be hard days leading up to it. And it's gonna be a pretty serious and sobering kind of time. And in fact, this did happen. This generation did not pass. These people did not die. Before Jesus, this generation of people did not. Before Jesus' prediction came true, 37 years later, after Jesus said these words, the temple in Jerusalem, in fact, was destroyed and laid waste to the ground, to the very foundations, by the Romans in AD 70. And the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem is a kind of foreshadowing of the end of the world as we know it and the start of the new world, the new heaven, the new earth that the Bible says that God will usher in. That's what we do know. And what we do know is that Jesus' words on this are trustworthy. He says, heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away. What we do know is that more people have listened to the words of Jesus than anyone else in the history of the world. That's what we do know. And what we do know is the things that Jesus have said have come true. What we do know is Jesus predicted his death, burial, and resurrection three times, and what we do know is that he raised. What we do know is that Jesus said that these things would happen, and what we do know is that they did happen 37 years later. What we do know is that the words of Jesus are trustworthy. What we do know is this is gonna happen. What we don't know is when it's all going to happen. But concerning that day and the hour, no one knows. This is an amazing statement. Not even the angels of heaven, nor the Son, but only the Father. That day will not be as easy to predict as the day that Jerusalem was destroyed, that's for sure. And isn't it fascinating and amazing that Jesus, the earthly Jesus says, I don't even know. I can't even tell you right now the day that that's going to happen. Only the Father, as Jesus divests himself from some of his divine attributes. And this is ironic, considering so many Christians spend so much of their time trying to predict this exact day, as David recounted to us last week. Even the earthly Jesus says, no one knows, not even the Son, only the Father. And you might have had the question like me, why? Why is that? Why doesn't God want us to know exactly when? Why does God not want, why would he not want us to know? This is such an amazing day. This is an amazing event. Why would he not want us to know? And you think about the amazing events in the life of your family. Why would you not just tell him in advance it's coming? And I think part of the reason for this is this, that God is like a good mother. God is like a good mother who knows that her kids will act differently if they know exact time that dad gets home. I know it was the case for my mom. Like, if she told us exactly when dad was coming home, if we knew the exact time, we would push the limits, right? If she said something like, hey, listen, if you're on your best behavior until dad gets home, there's ice cream after dinner. And we would then be on our best behavior until dad get home. But if mom told us, hey, you know, dad gets home at this hour, I mean, we would have pressed the limit until the very end. What we do know is that Jesus will return again. And the end of the world as we know it will cease, and the beginning of the new world will begin. And it will happen in the midst of the most everyday, ordinary things of life. That's another thing we do know. Did you catch that? In the days of Noah, this coming of the Son of Man will be like that. They'll be eating and drinking and marrying and giving in marriage. And he says, so will the coming of the Son of Man be. People will be doing the everyday, ordinary things of life. They'll be eating and drinking and having good meals. You'll do that today. Someone's coming to our house after church. We're going to have a nice lunch together. We'll be doing these kinds of things. We'll be planning weddings. I'm doing a wedding in a few weeks, right? We'll be doing all the normal, everyday, ordinary things of life, registering our kids for college, taking our kids to school, planning our family vacations, going to work, dropping the kids off at soccer practice. It's going to be the normal, everyday, ordinary things of life. There's not going to be some big announcement where everyone gets a chance to just clean themselves up, right? Just run home real quick and take an Italian shower and get ready for Jesus to come, right? You don't know what an Italian shower is, do you? It's just a little water on the face and some Stetson cologne. Come on, that's an Italian shower. Every Italian knows that. That's what you do if you don't have time, right? You don't have time for that, right? You don't have time to put on your Sunday best or get to some big event center where we all get ready for the big moment. It's not going to be like that. What we do know is you'll probably be doing something very, very normal. But the day and time when Jesus returns, if he tarries that long, two men will be in the field. They're going to be at work. Two of the guys are going to be at work. One will be taken, the other will be left. Two women will be doing their work, the mill. One will be taken, and the other left. In the midst of the everyday, ordinary things of life, this is what we do know. And what we do know is this, that knowing that that day will come, but not knowing when it will come, should inform the way we live every day between this day and that day. That's ultimately what we do know as Christians. That's what we know. That knowing that that day will come, but not knowing exactly when, it should inform the way we live this day and every day between this day and that day going forward. It should change things, and the question is how. How should that change the way we live? How should that inform the way we live? I'm going to give you four ways quickly here this morning. If you're taking notes, there's four things I'm going to draw your attention to in this regard. One, it should inform your personal integrity. Does that make sense already? I probably don't need to say much more, but it should inform your personal integrity. Saw someone nodding. Yeah, it makes sense already, right? You know as well as I do that it should. If you know that Jesus is coming, but you don't know exactly when, it will save you from living a morally lazy life or a morally licentious life. If you know that Jesus is coming, but you don't know exactly when, you will think twice about where you go or what you watch or what you say or what you are doing. Your personal integrity. If you know that Jesus is coming, but you don't know exactly when, you'll pay attention to those things mostly when other people are not watching, but when he is. You'll save yourself from moral laziness that just says, oh, well, Jesus is coming, and I think I'm pretty good, and I'm saved by grace through faith. It's all this good work stuff. I don't know. Like, he's going to return. And you will save yourself from moral licentiousness. Well, I don't really know the day or hour. It's been 2,000 years, and so everyone else seems to have fun with these things. Looks like I should just kind of run in this direction. And Christian, I'm telling you that knowing the day is coming, but not knowing when, it should inform your personal integrity. Jesus says, therefore, stay awake. Stay awake. He gives an illustration about what this will look like, right? About the master of the house and the night that the thief was coming. He would have stayed awake if he would have known. And so Jesus says, you also must be ready. You must be ready. And some of you right now, you're saying, wait a second, wait. I saw this when I was a little kid. Look, isn't this some kind of silly, like elementarily, like moral police scare tactic? No, listen, this is not a scare tactic. This is just a little play on words here, but you'll get what I mean. This is a care tactic, not a scare tactic. And you know what? Some scare tactics, they are care tactics. People use some of these, what you and I would call scare tactics, to help people that they really care about, right? To grab the attention of people that they love. Moms, can I ask you a question right now, just between me and you? Are you above scaring your kids into doing the right thing? No, you're not. I know you're not. I watch you parent. I watch you gals. Dads, are you afraid of this? Are you afraid to scare your kids into doing the right thing? You better go like this, because I watch you too. I watch you parent, and you watch me. We do this all the time because we care about our kids. You know, not just because we're trying to be moralistic or legalistic. We care about our kids. We want to save them from things. Growing up, I had a really loud, for a while, overbearing. Today, she's super godly Italian mom, you know? And when I was young, my mom would lean into me sometimes and say, listen, I am watching everything. I have eyes where? In the back of my head. And guess what? As a little guy, I believe that. I'd be like over here and be like, you know? It's like she's watching me. She's like, I am always watching. And as I grew up, you know what she said? She said, My friends are always watching. My mom was the president of the PTA. I was the Dennis the Menace, mess up all the time, creating havoc and trouble everywhere. And my mom would say, hey, when you're going to the movie tonight with friends, I want to let you know, all my ladies from the PTA, they're probably going to the movies too, you know? Whatever restaurant you're at in Irvine, someone's watching, you know? Irvine was a smaller town back then. So it started with, like, I'm always watching. Then it was my friends are always watching. And then when I got older and I kind of established a faith that was more my own, my mom told me, Jesus is always watching. And by that time, I knew that that was actually true. And if you're a Christian, you know that that's true. And if you even believe in God in any way, shape, or form, but don't know if it's Jesus yet, you know that God, that would probably be true. That God would probably see everything. You know, it's not just that Jesus is always watching, but that we should always be watching for him. That's the point here. And the question is, does knowing that Jesus will return, but not knowing when, does that inform your personal integrity at all this morning? Second thing, it should inform not only your personal integrity, but your missional intentionality. It should inform your missional intentionality. It should inform the way you live among people that don't yet know or love or follow or serve Jesus. Who is that faithful servant, the faithful one, who when his master has set over his household to give to them their food at their proper time. Blessed is the servant whom his master will find so doing when he comes. So doing when he comes. The purpose of a servant is to do what their master has asked them to do until the master says to stop or until the master comes back. When we leave our kids, when we leave our younger kid with our older kids, we say, hey, this is what we want you to do until we get back. What time are you coming back? Don't worry about it. Mom and dad are coming back whenever we want. Probably before you go to bed because they're teenagers and we're getting kind of old, right? But we'll be back just around sometime later. But your brother better get to bed at this time and better have this for dinner, right? And you better only watch this many shows and only play this many rounds of Fortnite, right? That's the only rules, right? You don't even know what Fortnite is anyway. So you just, who are you people? You need a 10-year-old. So anyway, these are the things, just these things, right? Right. And in fact, Jesus does tell us what he wants us to be doing as his servants. Jesus doesn't hide that. When we get to the end, he says, go, or in your going, this is a super famous passage, in your going, make disciples. Baptize them in the name of the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit. Teach them to observe all the things I've commanded you to do. These are the things at the end Jesus said the servants are to be doing. In their going, in the midst of the everyday ordinary things of life, work, soccer practice, the stuff around the neighborhood, all the things that were the everyday things, the eating, the drinking, the marrying, the giving in marriage, in the midst of all those things, because you know he's coming, but you don't know when. Go, as you're going, make disciples. And the question is, are these the things that we are doing? Does this inform our missional intentionality? Does the idea that Jesus is returning inform the way we live toward people that are outside the walls and windows of this church or the church? In your going, are you making disciples? When was the last time you were in the tub with someone baptizing them on a baptism Sunday? Are you meeting with anyone right now? Is there someone that you're sitting down with and you're teaching them the things about Jesus one-on-one, just one person to another? That's not what pastors do. That's what Christians do. Are you sitting down with someone and teaching them about the things of God, the things about Jesus? These are the things that he's asking us to do. And the question for us this morning might be, what do you want to be doing when Jesus returns? What do you want to be doing in the midst of the everyday, ordinary things of your life when Jesus returns? Do you want to be doing all of it just to kind of build your family and get on with the things that you want to get on with and sort of kind of have this sort of image or persona or accomplish the things that you want or get the house that you want or have your kids behave the way that you want? Or in the midst of the everyday, ordinary things of life, you want to be found doing those things in that posture or as you're going and in your going, making disciples? Does knowing that Jesus will return but not knowing when inform or impact your missional intentionality? Would that impact the way that you live differently? There's a great reward for living with this kind of personal integrity and this missional intentionality and to the end. He says, truly, I will set him over all of his possessions. There is an eternal reward for those who live their lives in light of his coming, who live this day in light of that day, that's for sure. And we don't know completely what that will look like, but my assumption is it's going to be pretty good. But just as there is a great reward for those who do live this way to the end, there's also a great regret for those who don't live this way to the end. And that brings us to our third point, is that this should inform your internal security. I think I got someone's attention right now. Yeah. So this gets a little bit more serious. Not just your personal integrity, not just your missional intentionality, but this should affirm or inform, rather, your eternal security. Did you see at the end of that passage, he says, in that place, this analogy about the master and the servant, there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Super sobering picture. This picture of the weeping and gnashing of teeth is it goes along with the imagery of Gehenna or hell in Jesus' day. And if you're not yet a Christian, I know it's a kind of a crazy reality, but Jesus talked more about that reality, the reality of hell, the reality of a life separated from God and his presence than he did about a lot of other things. A lot. Like, a lot. And that should tell us something. And this point is so important to Jesus that he doesn't just leave it there, the weeping and gnashing of teeth. Actually, Jesus tells an entire other parable to drive home this point, that it should inform our eternal security. The kingdom of heaven will be like 10 virgins, 10 young ladies who get their oil and their lamps. They're getting ready for this wedding party. And some of them are foolish and some of them are wise, right? And the foolish ones, they don't take any oil with them. They don't prepare. They're not prepared. They get the invitation and they get all excited. Oh, we're going to a wedding. How many of you guys watched yesterday? Anyone? Scared to raise your hand, it's fine. Okay. So you get all excited. Look, weddings are exciting, right? But then they don't prepare. They don't get ready. But the other ones are the wise ones who are prepared. They take the oil. The foolish bridesmaids in this parable, look, they've accepted the invitation. And they think that accepting the invitation to the wedding party guarantees their place in it without any preparation for it. Did you hear that? The foolish bridesmaids, they think that just receiving the invitation means that they're going to be accepted into the wedding party, regardless of their preparation for it. And I think there is a grave danger in evangelical Christianity, especially in our country today, where we can just call people to events and ask them to pray a prayer and just assume that everything is fine in the end. And they can live whatever way they want between that day and the next day. And there's no evidence and there's no preparation. And they can just assume, oh, I received the invitation. Some guy said, do you want to receive Jesus? And I said, yes. And I had this experience. And so when the time comes, I'm going to be in. And what the parable teaches is, no, look, the preparation, the intentionality is proof positive of a real, true interest in the bridegroom and in the wedding party. You're really interested. Some of you sheepishly raised your hand watching yesterday. Some of you were like, oh yeah, I'm all about the royal wedding. You're connected. There's a genuine interest. You might have prepared a little cup of tea and some scones, you know, and turned on the TV and watched. I know someone who did that, not in my house, but in another house. And you know what this is like when you get a wedding invitation? Some of us get wedding invitations and if it's someone that we're not really, really connected with, we're like, oh, what's the date for that? And we put it on the date and then what happens? We forget about it until that week and someone else wants to do something like, oh, sorry, I can't do that on Saturday. I have a wedding. But if it's a wedding for someone that you're really vested in relationship with, that you really love, you really care about, you're really excited about, you are counting down the days. You are looking forward to that, right? Unless you're a dude who doesn't like to dance. And then you're like, you're just never looking forward to a wedding. But other than that, caveat, right? Like, this is the way it goes. The bridegroom was delayed. They got drowsy. The bridegroom showed up. Here he is, coming out to meet him. And the foolish ones said to the wise ones, hey, give us your oil, for our lamps are going out. And the ones that prepared said, hey, you need to go buy that for yourselves, or we're not going to have enough. You know? And on that day, that great day, when that great meeting happens, please listen really careful to me. You will not be able to rely on someone else's preparation. You will not be able to rely upon your parents' preparation or your grandparents' preparation. You will not be able to rely upon your spouse's connection with God. You will not be able to rely upon your friend's connection with him. It will be on you. It will be on you. And there will not be enough time to prepare. It's not going to be on your family, not going to be on your friend, not going to be on your spouse, not going to be on your kid, not going to be on your church. It's going to be on you if you've prepared or not. And while they were going to buy, the bridegroom came, and those who were ready were met with him at the marriage feast, and the door was shut. And on that day, when that great meeting happens, you won't have the time to make things right. It'll be too late. It's just going to happen in the midst of an everyday moment of your life. And he say, Lord, Lord, let us in. You know, please. He answered, truly, I say to you, I don't know who you are. Did I send you an invitation? And the last place we see this idea of Lord, Lord is back in Matthew chapter 7, another passage, if you've been a Christian a while, that you read it over sometimes, it kind of scares you a little bit, you know. Talking about these kind of charismatic Christian leaders who rely upon experience-based kinds of things, and their faith is all really grounded to that, or quote-unquote faith is all grounded or based in that kind of experience. And these kinds of Christians sometimes, or professing Christians, they seem to emphasize this kind of experience over obedience. And the point of this passage is that obedience, it trumps experience every time. As a sign that you're really who you say you are, obedience trumps experience every single time. So does knowing that Jesus will return but not knowing when, does that inform or impact your sense of your eternal security? Can I humbly say? I think it should. Which leads us to the last implication. We're having fun, aren't we? Number 4. It should inform your ethical curiosity. Now listen, I'm saying all these things and I'm looking out and I'm assuming, I know there's someone. I don't know how many, but there's someone. Someone is having a problem, an issue right now. Some of you are listening and you're thinking to yourself, man, you know, I'm listening to some of this stuff, Matt, and the end of the world thing, I don't really like talking about this in the first place, but I'm looking at some of these stories, and so like, and these are stories Jesus is telling about some like manager guy, some master guy who comes back and like cuts people into pieces. Like, what is that all about, you know? And there's this guy that's like the bridegroom, and there's like people are like, they want to come in actually at the end. They realize they want to be there. They just, I mean, golly, they didn't prepare. They're not let in. He says, I don't even know who you are. Like, did I send you an invite? Like, that doesn't seem like very loving. It seems to me that God is super loving, and that seems like judgmental. There's some kind of judgment or justice going on there. And that just feels like, I'm kind of like in this ethical dilemma. You know, maybe I'm even interested in Jesus, but now I kind of like, I don't know, kind of don't feel so interested, at least this morning. And if that's you, I want to say there definitely is a reality that there is a tension in love and justice. And that the Bible teaches that actually God is totally loving and totally just. He's perfectly loving and he's perfectly just. And so what you're seeing this morning is a just and, I would submit to you, a loving picture of who God is. Listen to me. If God is loving, he has to be just. If God is loving, there has to be a judgment day. Listen to me, if there is no judgment day, there is no hope. If there is no judgment day, there is no hope for the person that has been abused. There is no hope for the person that has been taken advantage of or disadvantaged because of someone else's sin against them. If there is no judgment day, there is no hope for things to be better for people who have been just had a horrible lot in life and at the expense of other people who have sinned against them. If there is no judgment day, there is no hope that there's never going to be genocide and starvation. There is no hope that there's never going to be people wronging each other and liking it. That there's never going to be conflicts between one people group and another. There's no hope that it's ever going to end, and there's never going to be any consequence for it. If there is no judgment day, there's no hope that the people who have offended and sinned against in such vile ways, so many people, will ever get or see any kind of justice. If there's no judgment day in the end, there's no hope. And yet, if there is a judgment day, there's no hope for you and I. Because you know as well as I do that your sin is, that you're implicated because of your sin in some of these things. And maybe not the big bad ones that I'm mentioning, but you know the ones. And so you know that there's this crazy tension going on. If there's no judgment day, then there's no hope for justice. And yet if there is a judgment day, there's no hope for me because I've done some things that are really unjust. And at the same time, if God is loving, like what about this justice piece? But if God is only like a judge and he's just, like what about his love? And I just want to humbly say, if you're in this kind of ethical dilemma this morning, if you feel this tension, what I want to do is I want to point you to the cross, which is the crux, literally, of Christianity. I want to point you to the cross this morning where actually the love and justice of God meet perfectly. I want you to point you to the cross where Jesus is so loving that he goes and takes on himself on the cross all of the justice from God that we deserve. Listen, if you're not yet a Christian, this is what the Bible teaches. I don't know what you've heard about Christianity, but this is what it is. That Jesus lived a perfectly sinless life before God. That Jesus lived a life we could never live. A perfectly sinless life before God. And the Bible teaches that he lived that life on our behalf. That's the whole point of the whole thing. We could never do it, and he did it in our place. That's what the Bible says. That Jesus lived a life that we could not live. That he died a death, listen to me, please, that we should have died. Like we deserve the punishment of sin. We deserve the weight of sin and injustice and all of that on ourselves. And yet Jesus took it on his shoulders. The Bible teaches that Jesus had all of it on him. The Apostle Paul says that he became sin. For God made him who knew no sin, that is Jesus, to become sin for us. That in him we might become the righteousness of God. That God placed all of our sin on Jesus on the cross. And when we place our faith and our hope and trust in him, as the Son of God come to save us from our sin, that his righteous record toward God, his right record toward God, is attributed to us at the very same time as all of our sin is attributed to him. And all the justice, for all the injustice in the world, Jesus goes to the cross for, and he bears the weight of it for you and for me. And so that you and I one day will be able to walk and stand in front of a God who is perfectly loving and perfectly just, and to know beyond a shadow of a doubt that Jesus has already taken all the justice. And all we get is the love and affection and approval of God. And that's the good news for us this morning. And it's this. That Jesus took on himself all the judgment of God so that all we have to look forward to is the joy of being with him. And if you're like me, and every once in a while you get a little nervous about the end times, you get a little nervous about the last days, you get a little nervous about what that will really look like, maybe there's not always a sense of joy, there's a little bit of sense of trepidation, and can I just pause for a moment and say, it's actually probably a good thing. But mostly, it should be a lot of joy. Let me just for 1 minute go back to this fig tree, the lesson from the fig tree. As soon as its branch becomes tender and puts out leaves, you know that what? That summer is near. And this is a picture of our hope and what we have to look forward to. You see, the fig tree loses its leaves in the winter, and it goes through a cold winter with some sleet and freezing rains and it just gets bombarded. It is a cold season. And yet eventually things begin to change and spring comes around and its buds begin to bloom. And there's this sense of hope and joy that summer is here. And summer for them, the late spring, summer was harvest season. Harvest season is here. Abundance is here. Joy is here. Summertime. I got two teenage daughters, man. They are counting down the days. Right, till school's out. They're Laguna Beach trolley hoppers, right? One of them has a car, so they're probably not hopping trolleys anymore. But they're just there every day, you know. They can't wait for summer to come. Oh, they can't wait. If you lived in a place like that where those seasons come, you know the analogy that's here. And the reality for us is that we live in a time that Jesus says where people's hearts are going to be growing cold. And there'll be a cold kind of spirituality. And it will seem overwhelming. And then spring will come. And then the buds will break. And then you'll know that it's near. And then you and I will have to look forward only to the joy of harvest time and of summer and of being in the presence of the sun. It's good news. Would you pray with me? Lord, this morning I know there may be many days between this day and that day. Lord, I also know that there may be very few days between this day and that day. And I know we posted on Instagram this week, you know, would you be okay? Or what would you do if Jesus showed up after church on Sunday? Would you be ready if Jesus came after Sunday service? And that, I know it's a provocative question, but it's a legitimate question. That could be what it is. At lunch today, in the midst of the everyday things of life, kids falling in a fountain, getting wet, people trying to eat and have peace, but all the controlled chaos going on around them with the kids running around and family, it just could just happen in a moment. And so between this day and that day, would you help us to live in this tension? We look forward to that day now as we sing these songs to you, Jesus, as we remember your body given for us, your blood shed for us, so that you took on all the justice and we get all the love. As we give of our tithes and offerings, reminded of just how much you have given to us. So we respond to you, we look to you, and to you alone.